And for our speaker today, I'm going to hand this off to Koji.
Hi, everybody. I'm Koji. I'm the head of training here. So Sagan Johnson was scheduled to give today's Dharma talk. She was planning on coming into town driving from Madison. And her father had an emergency medical situation, so her and her sister are going to Illinois to take care of her father. So I'm sorry, Sagan's not going to be able to make it today. We found out yesterday afternoon. So in deciding how to pivot, we decided we didn't want to, it'd be a shame to replace Sagan with the usual suspects, especially if you were anticipating a change of pace. So we decided to, we invited Keika and Jinzu, the two newest members of the Clouds and Water Teacher Udyo, to kind of have like a little panel discussion about their path. And so the Teacher Udyo is, in some temples called like a practice committee, but it's kind of the cohort of people who have been empowered to give guidance in practice and training. So Ryo is this kind of suffix word that means like a group or a committee or something like that. So we're gonna have a little discussion with Keika and Jinzu, and they'll be able to introduce themselves in a moment. Mm-hmm. Good morning, everybody. Do we have the lavalier mic to pass back and forth between us?
Yes.
Great.
Yep, that's it.
Okay. So if you find that when you begin talking, sound does not come, trust that it will be forthcoming.
Is sound coming?
It will. It will. Just flip it on.
I'm going to pass it back and forth.
Okay.
Can we just clip it right here?
No.
No.
It won't work. It needs to be within like 3 inches of your face. By way of starting, I was hoping that you could, I think we'll get into like the kind of priesty stuff in the second wave, but maybe in the first wave, a little bit of just kind of like personal background, what primed you for encountering Dharma and what made the hook set when it set, if it did, you know, in terms of wanting to like, you know, kind of pursue it as professionals.
We're professional.
Or else, you know, like something central to your life.
Okay, you go first.
Oh, I was told last night that you have to go first.
I know. It's okay, I'll go first. Well, thank you so much for being here. Good morning. And good morning to everyone on Zoom too. Thank you for being here. So my name is Jinzu Minna Jan. I use they, them pronouns. And before I talk about me though, I wanted to add a little bit of ancestor acknowledgement. First, I wanted to bring into the space, you know, into my body, heart, and mind, into clouds and water, for those of you who wish, into your bodies, hearts, and minds, a Soto Zen priest and anarcho-socialist named Uchiyama Budo, who lived in the 1800s and 1900s in Japan, was killed in 1911 in Japan. But he's a real inspiration for me. I think he asked himself really practically, how does our spiritual practice uphold or dismantle empire? He was very anti-imperialist and was killed because of it. But he believed with his whole being that our bodhisattva vows practically are and were for caring for community, caring for the collective liberation of all. And that includes, you know, access to land, food, education, shelter. And then the second person is senior and wonderful Dharma teacher, Larry Ward, who died this week. And Larry and Peggy, yes, were here as guest teachers in 2016 and 2022, and he will be greatly, greatly missed. I just want to take a moment.
One of our Zoom friends is also holding up the book.
Yes. So anyway, Larry Ward's teachings live on. And I really hope, if you're not familiar with Larry and Peggy's work, that you'll So the Lotus Institute is the organization through which I taught and still teach. So yes, my name is Jinzu, and a little bit about me. I identify as trans, disabled, a person of color, a child of immigrants. And I think all of those things in one way or another led me to Buddhism, to the Buddhist path. Koji and I are partners and live together, and on the drive here, which is how I was able to be like, ask Kate first. But on the drive here, we were talking about, you know, what is it? What is it that makes me have a great wish to be a priest, to be a teacher, to be a religious leader during this time in this tradition? And one of the things that I mentioned to Koji was that I really, I think that kind of Pan-Asian cultural history is fascinating. I'm a big nerd, and I want to always be learning. And I love Mahayana Buddhism, that Zen Buddhism is within the stream of. I'm particularly interested in Mahayana Buddhism and the kind of history of it, the different teachings, the different ways that different things have been interpreted. But really at the end of the day, it wasn't my head that brought me to Buddhism and to Zen Buddhism. It was that I was suffering. I was particularly suffering from and with systems of oppression and internalized oppression. And so by the time I found myself on the cushion, it was kind of Soto Zen by accident, because that's what I had access to. I wouldn't have chosen Soto Zen if I had access to different kinds of Zen. I think at the time I wasn't into the sort of austerity of our practice in the US and Europe, the sort of monochromatic clothing, the monotone chanting, the lack of singing, the lack of color, the lack of, you know, gold adorned things everywhere. But it was what I had access to. And so I, you know, I kept going and learning, and then discovering as I did that, that this is truly where I want to be. But yeah, it was, I hit a wall, as an activist and just as a human being. I just, I would say, I was already studying and practicing Buddhism and Soto Zen Buddhism by the time Trump was elected the first time. But when he was elected the first time, I hit a huge wall, just this enormous, impassable wall within my heart and mind and body. And I went to a monastery in California to, you know, sit in the dark for 3 months and stare at a white wall and be alone with myself in community. So like held by community, but alone, to really, you know, turn towards that wall. And I discovered in doing that, that wall was internalized oppression, and started taking this, like, some serious steps towards dismantling that or excavating that. And so I would say that's what really, you know, the interest was already there. The curiosity was already there. And I would say a vocation to be living and leading a spiritual life was already there, but the hook set, as Koji said, for Soto Zen Buddhism, during that first 3 month residential practice period that I did, where I really experienced a lot of harm in that historically predominantly white community, but I also got to deep dive into Mahayana and Soto Zen Buddhist teachings and experience the kind of medicine that they could be for me. So with that.
There's so much more. Gosh, thank you for inviting me to join you. Sagan Johnson is a big person because in her absence, two people.
And that's not even enough.
So, and thank you too for letting us hold forth. So who am I and how did the hook set kind of thing? So my name is Keika. Karin is my name also, other places. I take she, they pronouns, and I started coming to clouds in 2008. And why did I come to specifically clouds? Because I had access to it. I was very miserable. I just had a breakup, but I kind of also, so I was miserable because of that, but I kind of had a larger misery of like, where is my life going? And is it time to be a Buddhist? Which, not that I knew anything about Buddhism, but it was just like, it might be time to be a Buddhist. So I looked in the web, where's the Buddhist place? What is he, what even is it? But then I went to Lumbertown, and then I just never went anywhere else. Actually, my first teacher was Sosan's kid, who was five, who wasn't scary to me. Because there were all these weird people in robes. I'm like, I am not talking to them. I'm Filipino American. I come from a Catholic tradition. You don't talk to people in robes. So I was like talking to this 5-year-old wise person. I'm like, what's going on here? What is this room? What is that room? And they explained all this stuff to me. Okay. And then I just kept coming only on Sundays. I would come at 9 o'clock, have Noah sit, which was very healing for me to sit with other people, even though I didn't really know why we were doing that. And then there was a talk, and I didn't understand anything anyone was ever talking about. This seemed fine. You know, it wasn't like bad or anything. And then all these white people who had Japanese names, super weird. So I was like, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's good. It's like, okay. It's probably helping me. And then I would go to Mississippi River Falls and just like hang around. And those were my two medicines on Sundays. And then I just kept doing it for the only reason that it just seemed like a good thing. And then at some point, or maybe I started in 2005, and then in 2008, Byakuran asked me to be on the board. I'm like, I just got here. Well, we need people of color. It's like, well, that's the usual reason. But my thought was, well, maybe if I'm on the board, I actually meditate, because that seems to be a good idea. It didn't help me meditate. But I did learn a lot about clouds, like a lot. Like so much, I didn't even really want to know. But it really does. You should know. If you come to a place, you should know. You should know the history. You should know the people of it all. So I learned all of that. And I stayed on the board, because maybe that was something I could do. And I stayed on the board for like way too long. Like I stayed on the board for 13 years, which isn't even allowed, actually. Like we found out it was actually against the rule, but there I was. And then I got off the board because I was going to go on the priest path, and you can't be on the board and be a priest. But I don't really know why I'm on the priest path, so I'm going to avoid that question. However,
that's the next question.
Well, we'll get there when we have it. We're not in the now yet. So, but a little bit about maybe culturally, because I think that was sort of Jinzu's context, which I want to relate to a little bit. Just a funny joke I thought of before this, like we're sort of both the wrong kind of Asian for this. So Asia is a very big place, and the scholar in me would even say Asia is a fantasy of the West, doesn't even really exist. But being essentially in my day job, which is also my weekend and my night job, I am a faculty member at McAllister College. And I'm actually the chair of American Studies, so you can find out all about me there. And how I even got there was because of my Asian American activism that then led into a scholarly job. And I would say that my area is Asian American activist studies. And within that, I study the Vietnam anti-war movement, and I also study critical prison, like a kind of abolition approach to prisons. Those are kind of my two areas. And right now I'm teaching a course on the Hunger Games. So that's like to tell you a little bit about me. But culturally, we're the wrong kind of Asians because we're in Soto Zen, which is a Japanese, you know, religion, basically. It is a religion, by the way. And also it has Chinese roots, which I'm finding that I relate to a lot, the Chinese roots, perhaps because having Filipino heritage, that's also connected. And there's a lot of like weird contradictions and hooks. Puzzles, like puzzles you can't solve, or I can't solve, about why I'm here, because maybe I shouldn't be here in terms of heritage. Like my mother's family during World War II was garrisoned by the Japanese who had occupied the Philippines. So There's a lot of historical trauma in my mother's side of the family from that kind of Japanese contact where my grandfather was going to be executed. He was not executed, but they had to run and hide and live in strange places and stuff like that. And its story is still unfolding. So World War II was a bad experience and put a very bad smell of Philippine-Japanese relations. But maybe that was also like a seed, because then what did Japan also offer was Buddhism and the peace Buddhism that I'm attracted to. And then when I was 10, my auntie in the Philippines, who was a big role model for me, was in prison, was caught by the US-supported Marcos dictatorship. And for 13 years, she lived underground. And so for 1972, 1984, 86, 13 years, that kind of defined my life. This person who I heroized, who I sometimes saw, who I was supposed to look like, who kind of just, even if I didn't think about her all the time, turned out to really affect me. So when she died, shortly before I got ordained, all my hair fell out. So the head shaving ceremony wasn't much of a head shaving ceremony, but there was only like 3 years left. So now it's coming back. So this is a koan for me. Like, what happened? It went away. It came back, sort of. I mean, you know, life is full of koans. We don't need to read a book about them, although we do, and that's fascinating when we read the koans that we study as priests in training. So the hook is maybe in all those places. Like, I'm finding maybe it didn't have to be Zen, and it didn't have to be Soto Zen. It didn't have to be clouds and water. It didn't have to be this place, but it is this place. And these are my friends, and you are my teacher, and this is my community. And I care so much about it, and it feeds me. And as a priest in training, we're learning also to be the source, like also how can we also offer, if not in words, at least just in our presence, in our bowing. But that's kind of what we're learning. I don't know if that answered the question, but that's what I got.
Thank you. And if at any point you have questions for each other, if something like blows up, you know, give me the day off. I wanted to ask, and I think we started to explore it, made the initial excursions about the frontiers, but to get into like the particularity of the outfit and the priest stuff, and like how, you know, at what moment did that, you know, one of my teachers, Mel Weitzman, said that one day he was at the beach and he wrapped a towel around himself and he saw his shadow, and something just kind of kicked up. But seeing his shadow with the robe, with the towel around him, he's just like, oh, that's like a reflection of who I feel called to be, or who I'd like to be, something like that. And was there any kind of encounters or any kind of moments or any kind of experiences that made it kind of come to life for you? And what do you think it might mean? And we're notoriously vague as a tradition about what this is. So
this being the
this vocation. About, you know, what some places it's like very, very clear, this is what it means, and we're kind of like, you know, because what this isn't a monastic setting, there aren't particularities of the vows that are extremely different from that a layperson takes, you know. So one time someone was asked, what's a priest? And I was like, well, it's a more excessive fabric situation. what role does the fabric play in transforming your practice and your sense of yourself?
Okay, so I'm just gonna reiterate this question back to you, Koji, to make sure I hit all the points, which is, what role does the fabric play? The fabulous outfit, but also, and what does it mean? Mm-hmm. And how does that kind of relate to what this mean, this priest role means occasionally to me?
And in terms of personal story, I really like, and I don't know if it's necessary, if you skip it, you skip it. But like, if there was like this kind of like thing that happened where you're kind of like, shit, I want to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I really, you may be noticing there's a difference between what Keika's wearing and what I'm wearing. If you hold out your arm, Keika. Keika's got a big sleeve on. I think Koji doesn't, but So-san has a big sleeve. I'm very short, which means that and I'm not wearing that. But when I do, my sleeves literally touch the floor because I ordered my, that part is called the koromo. I ordered it from Japan. So it's like the official length with the official amount of fabric. And I'm 5'1". And so I have to keep my, hands in this like kind of shashu bow near my like solar plexus in order for my sleeves not to trail on the ground. I want to say one of the reasons, this is a little bit of an offshoot, but one of the reasons that I love being at Clouds and Water as a teacher and priest in training is because So-san, as my teacher and our guiding teacher here, has allowed all of us, including me, to lean into accessibility. And so even though I love the fabulous outfit, I'm on the autism spectrum. And so there are days like today where too much fabric, too many layers, too much weight, too much constriction makes me feel literally suffocated and I have an anxiety attack. And so today's one of those days. So I'm wearing instead this samoe, and Koji's wearing that on Koji's, and so is Juken. And that means work wear, essentially, samoe. And so it's this sort of much more utilitarian, almost like hospital scrubs or a... the outfit you would wear if you are a martial artist and you're at your dojo. So more easy to move around in. But that being said, I particularly love the textile and the texture, the sort of embodied practicality of the fabric in our tradition. And it's maybe one of those things that isn't talked about a lot, but we have a tradition in Soto Zen, in our particular lineage of Soto Zen, of sewing our own robes. And so the big part, this part, which is called the okesa, is we each sew these individually by hand or inherit them. Keika inherited hers, but has also helped sew many others and has repaired hers multiple times, and we sew the bowing mat, and we sew the small version of our robes, which Huku is wearing, and yeah, many people are wearing. They look like a bib, so that's basically an abbreviated okesa, rakusu, and I particularly get very inspired by materiality, something in this moment that connects me to my body, to the land, to all of the causes and conditions and critters and realities that made fabric possible and thread possible. And the fact that we're creating artifacts, you know, like in real time, we're creating artifacts and they're sacred. And in particular, the okesa is very Indian. And I'm Indian. And so I love feeling when I put the okesa on that I'm clothing myself in a garment that my people in India or people like my people in India would have worn, and that it was sewn in a way that they would have sewn, that hands that looked like mine, brown and kind of like gnarled and getting, as I'm in my mid-40s now, increasingly kind of wrinkly and a little misshapen. My grandmother's hands, right? That hands that looked like my hands would have sewn a robe that looks like this. And India is hot. And so a robe like this was pretty much sufficient. But I love that, you know, so you've got India in our robes, but you've also got China and Japan in the kimono and the koromo. And you've got beautiful history, like what I just shared. And you've also got some shadow sides, like these long trailing sleeves, when we wear the long trailing sleeves, make it so that we can't do manual labor. I wonder why, you know, I wonder what sort of social and political situatedness made it so that like a priest class wouldn't be expected to be necessarily scrubbing toilets or tilling fields. So when we step into our robes, when I step into my robes, especially the full kit, I feel like I'm stepping into the stream of 2,500 years of history, the shadows, and the really nourishing parts, both of it, both of them, all of it. And then I guess the last thing I'll say about the fabric, the materiality is, the story goes that back in the day in India, when these robes were kind of brought into being, sort of mendicant monks who would wander about offering the teachings in exchange for food or other support, they collected found fabrics for these, and they were fabrics from old birthing and menstrual rags. They were fabrics from charnel grounds, like where the dead are kept. They were the discarded fabrics that were considered too defiled to be worth anything. They were unsavory. You shouldn't touch that. And then they were dyed with antimicrobial things like turmeric and whatnot, so that they ended up this sort of like mixed muddy brown. And I think that that is beautiful. Just this idea of like taking that which is discarded, taking that which has been profoundly touched by just the most basic elements of reality of being a human being, birthing, living, dying, and repurposing it and saying, this is sacred, this defiled fabric that nobody wants to touch is sacred, and I'm going to wear it on my body. It's this combination. It's plural. So yeah, when I put on my robes, I feel connected to that lineage, and I feel it on my body. I feel it viscerally, and it really helps me. It reminds me like what it is that I've vowed. You know, maybe I don't know what it is fully, this koan of what it is to be a priest, what it is that this vocation is asking of us, but I do know what I vowed. And those are those precepts that Koji alluded to that are not that different from lay Buddhist precepts. For example, in Soto Zen Buddhism, we're not celibate. We don't need to be anyway. But I have the precepts that we receive at lay ordination, when we ordain, and when we're given full teaching authority, Dharma transmission, are the same. And they're essentially, I feel like, guidelines for how I vow to treat you, and what I vow not to do, and how I vow to treat me, and basically this like lattice by which I become a safer human being for myself and all beings. And I feel like I can use all the help I can get, you know, I really do. And so when I put on my robes, I feel like I'm putting myself, you know, we say in our robe chant, when we put on our robes, wearing the Tathagata's teachings, like wearing the Buddha's teachings. I feel like I'm wearing the Buddha's teaching. And in that moment, I'm not just Jinzu. I'm not just this little individual person. I'm also like being asked to step with solidity and strength into a position of leadership, which means showing up fully, but also decentering myself from that Dharma seat. And Sozan is actually a really big inspiration for me in that way, because I feel like Sozan has an incredible quality of fully embodying your power and taking responsibility for it, but not defending it. And so, yeah. Maybe that answered a little bit of what I think being a priest is.
Thanks.
There's so much more you could say, because you're also an artist and a textile artist and very familiar with fabrics and what they can do. And we sewed together a little bit when I was also sewing. Some different things that I guess I could add. So when we enter the priest path or whatever, one of the questions is, like, what is your archetype for a priest? Like, what is in your mind you're thinking about? So, you know, my parents are Marxists, and we never went to church, but sometimes we did go to church, and then I was like, why are we in church? And my mother would just be like, how dare you ask that? So I'm guessing it was fate too, but it was very confusing. But so yeah, people in robes, which are mostly men, although the Buddha, the nuns, the, so I was also very influenced by Catholic liberation theology. So the radical nuns, especially, and also radical priests, I have great respect also for the robe. But never thinking that I would be in one. So that was super weird. It's like, okay, you can be a priest. What do you think about a priest? And what do you think about a rope? It's like, not for me. I don't know. It's like super weird. And so you spend all this time talking with your teacher about that and with your peers. And yeah, it's just kind of a process, I think. We're probably all very ambivalent also about the hierarchy of teacher and student. And in Zen, it's very accentuated by the fact of like the Zen master thing. So I just think of it as like, yeah, we have these robes, and but we haven't done anything different than anyone else, but we really also shouldn't do anything bad different than anyone else. So we're going for a path of wholesomeness. And it's just that when we're more visible to ourselves and each other, there's more chances to do bad things. That's kind of how I feel like one thing Sosan has really from the very first time, it's like, and also don't do this, and also don't do that. Like you're gonna have all of this, and you know, something's gonna happen and you're going to have to apologize. That's just the way it is. And that happened very early for me, actually. Like I didn't even think I did anything, and then I'm already apologizing. So there's a lot that comes with this. And yet we are on a path to selflessness, like self-grasping, like questioning all of that. So even sewing the robe, how we sew the robe is a whole process of like, as Fiona, our sewing teacher, would say, it very easily becomes a thing. Like it very easily becomes a thing, and then I want this thing, and when is it going to be done so I can do this thing? I mean, like it's like one stitch away always from that. And everything we sew, so everything we're doing is like, where are you in this? And is it you or is it others? Are you with others? All these questions. In sum, what I think I like about the fabric is that it's a thing and it gets me outside of my head, like, because I have to sew it or I have to put it on or I have to figure out how to wear it. And then when I'm figuring that out, I have to say, who am I? Oh, you think you're so great? Okay. Let's see how great you are. You know, like all that stuff comes up all the time, and that's kind of what it is, I think. And then also the vow to do no harm, help others, do good things. Those are the basics that we're all here for. And now as teachers, we're being really held to it. You know, like we're seeing each other. Like, did you do it? Are you doing it? Who is you? Who are you anyway? Those kind of questions.
Who do you think you are?
Who do you think you are? Well, that's more like what my mother would say. Who do you think you are? My mother recently, on the road question, she said, when I visit you, so is there a certification? I'm like, you mean like a license that we can have the like, frame and put on the wall? And,
Literally.
Well, then I explained to her about lineage, and then I remembered Ketchimai.
Yeah.
So I showed her the lineage papers. Mm-hmm. So I showed her that, and then she was like, oh, you have spiritual ancestors.
Mm-hmm. I think I want to add something to my what do I think a priest is. And this is something that also came up in the car ride over. As Koji and I were talking about this, but I really, a big question for me right now, being a priest in training, having ordained and being a steward of a particular spiritual tradition, and then also being invited to be a member of the teacher, you know, as Koji said, the teaching team here at Clouds, which means I am a spiritual teacher for spiritual teachers. Whoa. And
hang on, everyone.
I think that this, you know, it goes without saying perhaps that this moment is to be volatile, you know, nationally and globally. And I know personally, I feel really hit by a lot of what's happening and myself, in my own body, my own life, but also in the extended like lives of my loved ones and community. And I think that I think a lot about movement chaplaincy, you know, or accompaniment, you know, like spiritual accompaniment of folks who are engaging in resistance. And resistance can look like marching, sure, but it can also look like developing mutual aid networks. It can look like just building community and caring for one another. How do I, as a priest, support that spiritually, right, through this lens? And then I also think about, like, what's it all for, you know? And while I think this is a really personal take on it, I really don't think that, for me, the Buddhist path is a self-improvement path, though it happens, you know? Like, I feel like I'm becoming a whole more wholesome and healthy human along the way. But that I don't understand English language idioms very well, but that plane is getting built or repaired or whatever as we fly it. And I really do think that what it's for is collective care and collective liberation. Like, I vowed to save all beings or awaken with all beings. And so that matters a huge amount to me, especially right now, always, but especially right now, where I just feel like the only way to keep going in this moment is with one another. And can I, in my role as a priest in training, as a teacher here at Clouds, as a steward of this tradition, support that? I have a question for you.
Oh, I was going to ask you.
Can I ask you first?
Okay.
We do have to fill out a discernment questionnaire when we decide we are curious about ordination. So that's where that question of, like, what's your priest archetype comes from. Did you name a particular archetype or person or character?
Oh.
You don't have to share it.
Oh, no, I mean, I just said, oh, sorry. I just thought of the Catholic priests and nuns. Yeah. So, I mean, in the generic Catholic priests, but also those radical priests and nuns, like literally these nuns, especially Filipino nuns, during the martial law period in the US, there was a whole anti-martial law movement. And the nuns, especially, will only wear their habit when it's time to protest. They put on the whole thing and then go out and be on the front lines. And in the Philippines, that's, and all over Latin America, that was the case also, that the priests and the nuns would lead because, you know, that's protection. It's a shield, right? And also those are the vulnerable ones. And in the case of Oscar Romero, the four nuns who were killed, they were also the victims of state violence. So I guess I'm stepping into that also. I love what you said about the spiritual transformation, because I want to tag on to that, because that's, so I'm already a faculty member. I've been teaching since 1986 in the college classroom. But in maybe the past couple of decades, I started to think of teaching not as teaching, like, give this, but more like, maybe give this, but also helping, like a helping profession, like a nurse. And I'm very fortunate to have someone in the room who knew me back then, some people, and Mari in particular, I want to just mention you because you just don't know who's teaching with you. And so back whenever that was, 2008, 2009 or something, when I was teaching a class about schools to prison pipeline, and I sent students out into the world to do internships, Mari was one of the internship supervisors. And then we also had an event for everyone. We brought everyone in there. So when Mari came here, she reminded me of this. And now I'm just thinking, wow, you just don't know who is helping all the time with you, you know? And I wasn't thinking about spiritual transformation then. And I'm really thinking now that for me, teaching, it has to be tied into some kind of spiritual life for me. And that is kind of like what I'm more concerned about. Like, I see spiritual crisis. And I want to be there, and I don't think it's handled by a syllabus, at least not fully handled by a syllabus. And maybe a syllabus is some of the harm. So that's kind of where I am.
How are we doing time?
We got a few minutes here. I wanted to ask one more question, and then if we have any time, we can have three questions from the assembly. So I think, to the best of my knowledge, in the 30-year history of Cloud Woman, we're the first not white teachers. not white teacher Rio members, and I'm curious about
Daniel.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
What?
Oh yeah. Okay. All right. Well, sorry.
Second and third.
So it's so in
this decade.
I'm sorry. So I'm wondering what's your assessment of like kind of like convert Soto Zen? And is anything missing, and what do you want to bring to the table? You know, what would you like to see? What would you like to?
It's a huge question.
Yeah, I thought we'd say, well, we got, you know, like 3 minutes.
Okay, I do want to be brief, because if there is time for like even a brief Q&A, that'd be cool. And then I want you have.
And I apologize for my misunderstanding. Sorry, I wasn't
carried away. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure this exactly answers that, but I do feel like a tremendous weight. Not in a negative sense, but just like gravity. I feel that that there's a tremendous gravity to being invited to be on the teacher Rio during this time. I feel extremely grateful to be stepping into that role side by side with Keika. And that the two of us as people of color are not alone in the heavy lift of being on a teacher team of all white bodied people other than us. So grateful that I have you by my side. And I also feel like there's so much to be said about meditation-based convert communities in the US and Europe in the Soto Zen Buddhist tradition. Clouds is one of those convert communities. But maybe I'll say one tiny sliver, which is that I think a thing I care greatly about and do think is missing across the board, even at Clouds, though I do think Clouds is taking steps, pretty significant steps to address it, is that collective care, collective liberation piece. I think that we focus a lot on ethics here at Clouds, which is great. It's not focused on enough in the US and Europe. But I often feel like that focuses on kind of like my vows, the ethics that I'm espousing, you know, what I will and won't do. And I'm curious about how I, in my role on the teacher Rio, and I'm also on the Ethics and Reconciliation Committee, can sort of support Clouds to keep planting the trees towards this like long arc change of being able to, you know, like shift that point of view, that lens to the greed, hate, and delusion of Clouds and Water Zen Center, like Clouds' ethics, our vows. I think, and the last thing is that I do think that there's often a disconnect between like what we do, which is often sit. we meditate, we study, so that we may meet what arises with an appropriate response, and that so that we may meet this moment piece, I think can get lost in convert Zen in general. So I'm also excited about continuing to kind of turn the lens towards that.
Yeah, this is like a 3-hour question. But I'm glad you're asking. I would just to tag on to that name, you know, I brought some books with me that people can come and look at if you want to afterwards, but they were very influential and sort of trace my growth here at Clouds and Water to knowing about these kind of issues. Early on, it was Byakurin and Wendy Morris who had some kind of efforts to bring people of color to Clouds. And I was part of those conversations, even before I knew like all the stuff that Jinzu and Koji that I've been learning, you know, in the past like 5 years about Zen Buddhism's history as a convert religion in the West. And also through Professor Jake Nagasawa, who's my friend, and also, well, I'm his boss at work, but whatever. He's also my spiritual like teacher on these other matters. So he's also been helping me understand like the origins of Buddhism in Asia and how it kind of came to the US and stuff like that. We're all learning together, you know, we're really all learning this together. And then we had other teachers come in besides Byakuren, Wendy Morris. Then there was Brother Dewberry, who held a whole Shades of Dharma. There was a whole bunch of people, including Bushin, Carol Iwata, and other people who, you know, we held it together. Kind of like when we were not sure whether this can be a home for us, because if other people can't talk about racism and name the strange aspects of an Asian religion where Asian people are actually diminished in talking about what the religion is, and if we can't talk about that, how can we actually be part of this? And then at some point, Ramon Hilda Baldokin came and took a bunch of us to Tassajara, under the explanation that, you know, people of color will not naturally have an access to something like that. And so we went for a week and we learned a lot of stuff about like the real Zen in California that these guys know well and looked at it. And then we found out that probably Koji was working in the kitchen when I went to get a peanut butter sandwich at that time. Another interesting story. So Ramon helped to expose us to the fact that we could be in this community, even though it seemed strange, and kind of pushed the doors open for us. And then later, people like Reverend Angel Kira Williams, Ayoya Tunde, and then we learned about who introduced this whole idea of Black Buddhism. Even Larry Ward bringing Dharma to us through his body and his history was part of that. But it was really Reverend Agent Kodo Williams who said Black and Buddhist, who named this as a movement. So then Asian Americans were like, what? So then where are we in this? And isn't that interesting how that cycle comes in? And then Chen Qinghang wrote this book, Be the Refuge. So that's really given us a lot to talk about in terms of different kind of Asian Americans with different kind of heritage in Asia coming to a religion that's Asian, that white people tell us that was deficient because they improved on it by taking the devotional practice out, because that's not very smart, but the meditation practice in, because white people know how to reflect and Asian people don't. And that those were the kind of things that are so damaging to our understanding of history and like what this is, this practice. That we have been working so hard, you know, together with all of our everyone in the teacher wheel. So personally, I feel very supported to be on this path. And there's many koans along the way. They're not only about race and identity, but we can't move without looking at those as well. That's what I would say.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Do you pass this up to you now?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.